Good morning. So last time we started off by talking a bit about arrays in C++, paying special attention to the issue of multidimensional arrays. And we saw that when we had a sort of native multidimensional array, which we declared with two dimensions, one line, we ended up with something which was stored in row major order. Each row, the first index you passed, was stored consecutively in memory. And I called this an array of arrays because we had basically one array stored right after the other, just like when we have an array of ints, we have one int stored one after the other. And we saw that this was different from when we had an array of pointers, that the storage is actually different. And we saw the example of an array of pointers with what gets passed to our main function if we want to take command line parameters. In that case, we get an array of pointers to C-style strings. And we saw that we can convert these to normal strings with some convenient methods, most notably a constructor which takes a string, or takes a C-style string of string, C++ string. Then we started looking at our next topic, which was Big O. And this is the whole idea that we're going to want to do asymptotic comparisons. And particularly, there's lots of things we could compare. We're going to spend a lot of time today talking about sort of abstract functions, which don't mean anything by themselves. But usually, we'll be looking at something which is an algorithm or like some operation on a data structure, how fast it is, or how much resources it needs. And we want to know, how does this work out when things get really big and when I ignore constant factors, which maybe I can improve by getting a better machine or like getting rid of little inefficiencies in my code, things like, you know, changing the sizes of my integers or something like that. Things that aren't that much of a big picture issue. So we can look at things that would make us not want to use an algorithm at all. We want to know, is this ever going to work when I have 10,000 users? Not how fast exactly is it going to be. And the advantage of these asymptotic comparisons is that they're something where we can make a decision without an implementation. Which is often something we'll be doing. We'll say, okay, what is this? Is this linear time, is it quadratic time, and decide, we're probably not going to do that. And this is because it's a theoretical comparison. We're going to write down a formula where we're going to say this is the number of operations something takes, or a number of operations possibly off by some constant factor, but we don't care because our comparison doesn't do that. And we can compute that pretty quickly without actually having written the C++ code and timed it. In fact, timing it won't reliably tell us what happens when the size gets really big because maybe we just can't run it big enough. And when we're doing these comparisons, we have these sets of functions. So when we find one particular function, we're going to want to compare it to others. So we have, and we're going to do this by defining a set based on some reference function. Typical reference functions we'll see are like n or n squared, nice simple functions. And our probably most well-known class was the functions that are big O of another, that are in big O of another function. And big O of a function is the functions which are asymptotically less than or equal to it, basically. All those functions are in big O of f. We had big omega, which was asymptotically greater than or equal. And we had big theta, which is often what people, when speaking informally, really mean when they say something is big O of f. And that's essentially asymptotically equal. That's the combination of big O and big omega. And we saw that in addition to sort of this informal idea of less than or greater than, we have this formal definition, which is based on comparing to C times f of n for all n greater than some n zero. And we saw these formal definitions last time. So any questions about any of these topics before I move on to talk a bit more about the formal definitions? So we have these formal definitions. For big O, we just say we choose a C, a constant factor that's greater than zero. We aren't gonna let you do negative ones. And we choose an N, zero, some number which is big enough that we start caring about the behavior. And we're saying that our other function is always less if it's in this class. And for big omega, it's the opposite. And we saw an example of applying this. We want to say that N is big O of N squared. This in fact isn't true for say N equals one. The inequality does hold for N equals one. So this is actually really easy. We can basically choose any N zero as long as we choose C, you know, one or greater. Let's look at a slightly less trivial case. So here we want to say is 10n in big O of n. So by this definition, we get to choose a C and an N zero, and we can choose it however we like to make this easiest. So one example is I'll just choose C is 11. So I know that's gonna make it easy to see that 11 times something is greater than 10 times something. And N zero is 2. And if I write this out correctly, we have a 10 there. But the inequality trivially holds out. So for n greater than 2, we can easily see that that holds. Hopefully elementary inequalities. And notice that I didn't choose the smallest possible c here. Like, I could have actually proved this with c equals 10. I didn't bother thinking about whether I could do that. I just said, 11's gonna be big enough. And that's generally the strategy you should have when you're trying to prove things like this. Don't bother deciding, you know, can I do better than this? Just say, if you're in doubt of whether your C is big enough, just make it bigger. It's probably gonna be easier to show the inequality holds. Yeah.
What about N zero? Like, do you have to choose the smallest possible N zero?
Do you have to choose the smallest possible N zero? Absolutely not. So if you're having trouble figuring out where the transition point is, don't bother. Just say, well, I know when we're at like a million, it's much bigger. You can just do that. So don't bother. You could go through the work of finding the smallest possible C and N zero to prove it. And maybe that's more elegant, but it's not worth your time. It doesn't change whether it's true or not. Okay, so this is for proving that things are in big O. And it's gonna be similar for big omega. We're just going to reverse the direction of the inequality. And for big theta, you just prove both of them and then you have the result. Then you have your total result. So if you wanted to prove that this is big theta, we'd prove that it's in big omega, which we do by choosing a smaller c. We could choose an arbitrarily small c that's greater than zero to do that, and then we'd say it's big omega, and then we know it's also big theta. And it, in fact, is the case that 10n is in big theta of n. So a note about proving the opposite. So sometimes you want to prove that something isn't big O of f. Isn't big O of G in this case. So our definition is that there exists a C and N zero, that we can choose some big C and N zero so that this inequality happens. And so when we say something's not in big O, we're saying there doesn't exist a C and N zero to make this happen. Which another way of looking at that is that if I claim, I have a proof it's actually in big O, here's my C and here's my N zero, you can come to me and say, nope, that doesn't work. Here's an example of an N where it doesn't work. So equivalently, you can say that for any C and N zero, I can find an N is a way of proving that it's not in big O. Because we're just playing that game where someone came to us with an alleged proof and we're telling them, no, you're wrong. So let's take an example of showing that n squared isn't big O of n. So we're going to play this game where we're going to say someone chose a C and an N0. So I'm going to choose an N which doesn't satisfy this inequality. And this is the N I'm choosing. Is this the smallest N I could have chosen? No, absolutely not. In fact, it is way, way bigger. Just so like I don't have to think about, am I going to have to change it? I just said, I'm going to take C plus 100. Why C plus 100? So I know that I don't have to worry about if C is less than 1. Well, got rid of the problem of that, like making us multiplying, making things smaller. And N0 plus 100, like these are not the smallest things I could have chosen. But once I do that, I say, okay, what's N squared? And this N I've chosen squared. It's C plus 100 squared, N plus N0 plus 100 squared. And we know that's greater than C plus 100 times N plus 100 times C. Because we know that C plus 100 is greater than 1, and N0 plus 100 is greater than 1. So squaring them makes a bigger number. And we know C plus 100 is greater than C, so C plus 100 squared is greater than C times C plus 100. So it's greater than this, and that's C times the bad N I chose, which is exactly C times our G of N here, which is N. Any questions on what I did here? Okay, yeah, and as I said, this is not the only way I could have chosen things. Like, I could have done something less, like the maximum of C plus 100 and N 0 plus 1. And there's other values I could have done to choose it, but I felt that this was a way where I could construct something I know was definitely going to end up big enough when we squared it to show that the inequality didn't hold. And that's generally the strategy I'd use. Like, you can add these big constants to make sure that you don't have to worry about, like, what if I'm squaring a number that's less than 1, and things like that. Okay, and so how about another positive example? So we have f of n is 100 n squared plus n, and g of n is n squared. So here to prove this, I'm taking C equals 200 and N0 equals 2. And I know for N greater than 2 that N squared, 100 N squared plus N is going to be less than 101 N squared. And based on that, I know that the whole inequality holds for the C equals 200. People look confused or.
Sorry, it takes me really long to write these down.
Okay, yes. It's the other reason I need to pause and ask for questions. Yeah.
So the number is 202, you just like pick those arbitrarily?
Yes, so the number is 202, I picked arbitrarily. In fact, I could have actually chosen 101, but I just didn't bother thinking about that. I just said, I'm going to choose something and hope it's big enough. Do the math and it works out. Yep, it was big enough. because one, n is where does the 101 come from? The idea here is that this n is less than or equal to n squared, so it's 100 n squared plus 1 n squared is 101 n squared. Yes.
So for an n cubed term, could you say that n is less than or equal to n cubed?
Yeah, for n greater than 2, like we did here, yes. For n cubed, the same sort of logic would hold. Okay. And I think we'll mention later that like there's this general rule for polynomials that like you'll probably just remember rather than proving it every time. Okay, any other questions? So my general idea is if you're doing Bibbo proofs, if you're proving the yes case, look at the inequality and try to choose a C and N zero that are large enough that it's definitely true. And don't bother finding the smallest C and N zero that work. Just choose one that's large enough that it's definitely true. Like you can, if you want a million, you can use a million. For proving the no case, the idea is that you're playing this game where someone tells you, yeah, this works for C, this C and this N0, and you're gonna show them wrong. So they're gonna give you a C and N0, and you're going to come up with a way of choosing an N so that doesn't work. Generally, what you'll do is you'll have a formula for N that's based on at least C and possibly also N0. To find an example that doesn't work. Note that you only need to find one counterexample. You don't need to actually show that the n you've chosen, that it's also a counterexample for everything bigger, even though it probably is. Like, you don't need to show that. It's probably true, but it doesn't matter. Once you find one counterexample, the definition doesn't hold. And again, you don't need to find the smallest n, you just need to show that they're somewhere there is an n that makes it not work once we've chosen a C and N0. So any questions on these strategies? Yes?
Proving the no case, you're not proving that there isn't a case, you're just proving that the one that's given to you is wrong, right?
So you're proving that no matter which one you give to me, I can find an alternative. So you're proving there is none, but you're doing it by in terms of someone gave you, in terms of, you know, symbolically in terms of a C and N zero. But you're not gonna just say, let's say someone gave me C equals zero, C equals 0.5. You're gonna say, let's say someone gave me any C. So you'll end up proving it for everything. Yes? Example for, so I guess I only had this one prepared. But here, what I did is I said, someone gave me a C and N zero. I don't know what they are, so I'm just using them symbolically. So I'm saying, whatever C you gave me, I'm gonna take C, that add 100 to that, and multiply it times N zero, which I also added 100 to. And that's the N I'm choosing. So it's gonna be like this, I'm not, like, the game you're playing is as if, you know, this is instruction, so if someone gave me a concrete C and a concrete N0, I could find a concrete N that fails. But we actually need to do it for all possible C and N, so we need to write it as a formula like this. But you can think of this as instructions, or if I just say, does it work for C equals 2 and N0 equals 10? And you can say, no, try this N, and so on. Yeah, you're picking a value that doesn't work in terms of any C or N0. Like you just, I couldn't choose a static N because I can always make C bigger. So I need to have it be a formula based on C. Yes?
So for N bad, you just chose to multiply C plus 100 and N0 plus 100 together?
Yes, so there are other things I could have done. So I believe that this works out. I'm not actually sure that they didn't work it out, but I believe there are other things I could have done. It just needs to be something where the formula would hold. And generally, the sort of game you'll play is let's construct a number which is an M which is really big, and also, you know, in some sense bigger than C, whatever C you were given. Because like if you were playing this game in person, you know, I give you C equals 100, and you say, okay, try a million, and I'm going to say, okay, what about if C is a million? And so that's why we have to have it in terms of C. Other questions on this? Yeah. So the question is, n bad always a function of c and n naught? So it has to be dependent on n naught, because otherwise, like if you choose a, otherwise I can always make, because you have to work even if n naught is really big. You can make n naught big enough. It's not necessarily always a function on C, but the cases where it's not are probably pretty boring. Like if I'm trying to prove things aren't big O of zero. Like then it doesn't matter what C I choose. But that's a very boring case. Or more realistically, like big O of 1 over N. That's a very boring case. I can pretty much choose. I guess for that even you need C. But so there's some really boring cases where it doesn't depend on C, but for almost all the time you need to use C, because otherwise I can make the inequality arbitrarily big. Okay. So since I'm putting lots of math on slides, I'm going to use some compact notation, and I'd like to talk about it. I think you may have seen this before, you may have not. I'll just mention it explicitly, since I would like to be able to use this. So this is for all n greater than zero. So this is choose an n for every n, possible n, such that n is greater than zero. I want to say something. And this notation, this backwards E, is there exists an n less than zero. So generally just read upside down A as for all, backwards E as there exists. Okay, any questions on these? Maybe you've seen these before, maybe not. Okay, so let's talk about what our definitions mean. So I have F is big in big O of H, and G is not in big O of H. F, G, and H are presumably all functions of some n, I just have not written down the n. So one possible statement is it true that if I choose any m greater than zero, that F of m is less than g of m, that there's that all the time, since f is contained by h and g isn't, that means that g is somehow always bigger. So this is saying that if we look at that, we have this scenario. G. Second statement says, well, maybe that isn't always true, but you know, at least there is an m so that this happens. So this is saying that I don't know what happens early, but there is an m somewhere, and I don't know what happens afterwards, such that we have g is bigger than f. And we have our third statement, that there is an m 0 greater than 0, so that everything bigger, this holds. So we're saying that we don't know what happens early, but eventually G is bigger than F and stays that way. Yeah.
The third statement, do we have M0 in the x-axis?
So the question is, what is M0 on this graph?
Yeah, it's greater than x-axis.
Yeah, so here this would be M0. And here this point would be M. So, let's think about this a bit. So who thinks that, so we have our 6 options here, some combinations. So who thinks that just one is the statement which is true? How about just 2? Just 3? So 4, which is 1 and 2. 5, which is 2 and 3. Okay. And 6, which is 1, 2, and 3. Okay. So everyone has the actual right answer. So let's go over how we can show that kind of formally. And a slight caveat, which is makes 3 subtly not quite right, but is very subtle. So, start with our first thing, that for all m, f is less than g. So this is our case where we're saying that all the way from 0, that f, g. And we have a counterexample here, where what ends up happening is that we have our f, and we have our g. And we have an h, which, you know, is something like this. That separates f and g asymptotically, like as we go out, h is between f and g, which is our intuition for why this should happen when we're dividing based on whether things are big O of h. But this is a counterexample because of what happens when things are small. This is an example of the principle that all these asymptotic comparisons don't mean anything when we're talking about small values. And here we have just concrete examples. F of n is 5 of n, 5 times n. G of n is n cubed. And h of n, the thing which separates the two, is n squared. So asymptotically, it just matters that it's n squared, n cubed. Like, those are in that order asymptotically. But when things are small, we have something different going on. So any questions about this example? Okay, or why this f and g I chose are have that relation those relationships with h. Okay. So let's talk about the case here. So here we're saying there exists an m, so f of m is less than g of m. And we can actually find this from our definition here. That when we negate the definition, we're saying that for any n0 and c0, there exists an n which is a counterexample. We said we could play that game, so we can take advantage of that. And this counterexample here is exactly the n we know must exist. We just say, well, f is big O of h, so I know an n and c, n0 and c. I'm just going to play my game with the proof that g is not big O of h. And by playing that and provide that c and n0, the n I get back, that's the one which is going to be the example where this is true. Any questions on how this works? Yes. What? Oh, that's instant. That is an error. Okay. Implies. I will correct this later. So that should, in fact, be an actual implies error. Yeah. I seem to have wanted to just copy and paste all my slides. No, they're not the same. Okay. So the third case is really tricky. And Bloomfield slides gloss over why it technically isn't true, because it's a very corner case that we don't really care about. And the intuition is that, well, g grows faster than h, so we're expecting that when things get big enough, we have this, we have our g, our f, and we have our h that separates them. That's the intuition as to what's happening. But we can do some nasty things. In particular, we can choose some g's that aren't very natural, like this one. This g is not big O of this h, because we can find one of the even values that makes that big O definition not hold. It's also not big omega, because we can find one of the odd values which makes that definition not hold. So it's this weird thing because it fluctuates all over the place. And this is why this isn't quite true, because you can have these really nasty g's that look like this. Of course, we don't expect function runtimes to look like that. We kind of expect that function runtimes have some nice properties, like that they don't get smaller as our size gets bigger. So we don't have to worry about this sort of thing with function runtimes. That will clean up this sort of example. But when we're talking about the formal definitions, we can construct these sort of functions, which are sort of not big O of anything, really. Okay, you know, they're not big O or big omega of that thing, because they're sort of a combination of two things. So what this G really does, is that it does something like this. And we still have our H and we have our F. So any questions on this? Yeah.
Can we define monotonic?
With our function over integers, this sort of thing is efficient, I believe.
Okay.
For monotonic increasing. Monotonic generally means doesn't change direction. And generally, I guess I haven't stated it, but we're only going to be considering big O over functions which are where n, the argument to the function, is an integer. And the function's value is a real number, presumably a positive one. Yes.
And will most of the functions we deal with also be monotonic?
So most of the functions we deal with be monotonic? I think so. Like, I can imagine problems which have a runtime like G. Like if you're determining if something's true, which is never true for an odd number of items, like you would have that sort of runtime. But I can't think of real cases where that comes up. Especially since we consider the worst case. So you have to think of, can you have an input that big where you're just missing an item in some way or something like that? Yeah.
Didn't you have a function that like starts out in squared and then goes flat for a while and then in squared again and then flat, but the amount of time it spends going flat is proportional to how much it is increased and in squared, and so it's like going up and down, back and forth across the...
So the question is, can we have functions which are in a different which are piecewise, but in a different asymptotic category because of that?
Yes.
Yeah. So I think generally you'll either end up with a situation where you have a hierarchy, or you get something like our G here, where it's not big O of H, but it's also not big omega of H. You'll end up with that sort of situation where it's not that it's somewhere else in the hierarchy, it's that it's not here or below it because of how it fluctuates. But I think you could define a function where each piece is like looks like n squared, but somehow it grows, looks like n squared or flat, and it's going to grow, and you could make it so that it ends up asymptotically growing in between, I think. Not sure how you do that, but it seems like it should be possible. Okay, so we have our intuition for how these functions work, which sometimes matches the proofs, especially when you don't have very weird functions like this G. So let's talk about generally what the hierarchy looks like intuitively. And we can imagine that there's this sort of number line of possible functions with different asymptotic complexities. And when we take big O, we're selecting a portion of this. That's an upper bound, so we're selecting a whole bunch of things that are, in this case, bounded by n squared. And when we select big omega, we're selecting a lower bound, so we have a whole bunch of things which are at least as big as n squared. And we have our overlap, and there is always going to be overlap because at the least, n squared is big O of itself and big omega of itself, and that's going to be true for anything, pretty much. Anything that isn't like non-monotonic like what we saw before. And we call this intersection big theta. So there's a few other regions on this picture that we could name, and in fact do have names, like big O, big theta, and big omega. So that's our big theta. So there's also something called little O. So that's this region here. So little O is basically strictly less than. And what we do is we take our definition and require it to be strictly less than instead of less than or equal. There's also a region which is strictly greater than. So there are these three variants. And I guess it's not actually quite as simple as changing that. The inequality, there's, I think, needs to be some restriction on C. I should actually look that up. But the intuition, when you see these, we won't use them very often. They're used very rarely in computer science, but you might see them occasionally, is that little o is asymptotically less than, that no matter, that always when we choose a C, we get strictly less than. So the intuition is that it's the stuff that big O doesn't overlap with big theta. And formally, there's a little few extra details we haven't shown you. And little omega, which is what this is the part which is strictly greater than something. So you might see these occasionally. Usually, in this class and in general, when you read about algorithms, they'll spend most of their time either using big O, big omega, or big theta. They won't care about the others, but on occasion, there might be a reason to use something else. Okay. Any questions on these? Okay. So these are our alternatives to big O. So we showed you one definition of big O, where we have this, choose C and N0. There's an alternate way of defining big O, all the variants. Which is with a limit. So I assume most of you haven't seen LimSup. Is this, who has some idea what LimSup is? Okay, a few people and not most of the class. So I'll talk about that in a second. And so basically we can say that we're comparing two functions, we're looking at the limit over time of the ratio between the two. And we're saying that if f is big O of g, then this is finite. If f is big omega, this is greater than zero. And this is assuming these functions are always positive, of course. And if it's in the middle, it's big theta. If it's zero, it's little o. If it's infinite, it's little omega. And this is just another way of capturing the sort of intuition behind the formal definition I showed you for big O and big omega and big theta earlier. And it ends up being equivalent. Like actually exactly equivalent for at least the functions we're interested in, where like n is an integer and we don't have to worry about things like real numbers and things like that. Okay. So for the most part, you can just think of this limit as being a normal limit, but it is technically LimSup for limit superior. And this means we only care about the upper bound. And that might not actually hold for here, but we only care about the upper bound. That's how we deal with that case where we define our funny f of n functions. Yes?
So when we compare those two functions, f and g, we just care about the upper bounds of each?
In a limit-based sense. So you still care about as you're going to infinity. I did not write it here, so n goes to infinity. You still care about the limit as n goes to infinity, but we don't. If the functions are fluctuating, you care about the higher value of the ratio. That's what this is saying. But in the functions we care about, that's usually not a difference. So for the most part, we're just going to take the limit. It's going to be the same. But This tells you what to do in the corner case where the limit wouldn't exist otherwise. Because that's what happens when you have that this sort of fluctuation. If you remember your calculus, maybe kind of, I don't know if they even cover that typically in calculus because people don't like all the cases where limits don't exist. Okay. So that's on an alternate definition, and yes, I think this probably actually needs to be a different kind of limit, if I'm thinking about this carefully. Because we don't want to take the upper bound for big omega, because in that when that fluctuates, we probably actually want the lower bound to say, no, it's not really strictly greater, but I'm not actually sure. But as I said, we typically don't use big omega or little o, which is why I don't know. Okay, so talked about definitions. And we actually went to reason about big O, so for the most part, we're going to use some nice informal properties. So one thing is that big O of F plus G is the same as big O of the maximum of the two. And this also holds true for big omega and big theta. If F is big O of F and G is big O of H, then F is big O of H. Or F is big O of G. Wow. That G. Yes, I just did that. Okay. That is not the button I wanted to press. Okay, let's do this properly. So, yes, if F is big O of G, and G is big O of H, then that holds. And another property that always holds, which is probably what I was being confused with when I type that typo up there, is that F is always big O of F. Some other properties, that if F is big O of G, G is big omega of F. If F is big theta of G, G is big theta of F. So this F plus G, this holds for all three of the asymptotic comparisons we're interested in, along with this, and we have sort of a version of this for the others, but not what we're showing. And F is big O of F holds for big theta and big omega. This is big O, big a relationship between big O and big omega only. And big theta, we have this reflexive property because it's kind of like inequality. And here we have this property because they're kind of like less than or greater than. And that actually does work. So big theta, because it's kind of like equality, we have all our usual reflexive and transitive properties that you would expect. Yes?
Why did you say it does not hold for big O and big theta?
Which does not hold?
It says like does not hold for...
So why does this not hold for big O? So one example is like, one is in big O of n squared, but n squared is certainly not big in big O of one. And before I finish up, one brief note So sometimes you see people write this. So I've been careful not to, but they usually mean the other thing. They usually mean in the set, but we're going to talk about sets, and I'm hopefully going to be careful about that. I haven't mentioned. Okay, and we'll finish up talking about Big O next time.